Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
Seed oils is very much like an online social media kind of like term. It honestly is the most perplexing thing I've ever experienced. First of all, I had never heard of the term seed oil. I have a PhD in nutrition science. I had never heard of this term until a few years ago on social media. Like, this is just a social media made up term. Like, we call them vegetable oils. We call them, you know, polyunsaturated fatty acids, or we call them by the oil that we're actually studying or looking into. But it genuinely flies in the face of nutrition science research. Listen, if seed oils were the cause of all our problems, I would be the first person to like step up and say, like, I'm not like in big seed oils pocket. I don't care about seed oils.
Hey friends. So before we jump into today's episode, I want to set the stage because it's an important one. So if you're a mom and your algorithm is algorithming, you might be inundated with a lot of information about this can harm your baby. This food is going to cause ADHD. Seed oils are terrible. You're going to get cancer. I know I have been lately, and the pressure has felt very nonstop. So today's guest is someone that I've admired for a long time. I've been wanting to talk to her for months. Her name is Dr. Jessica Nurek, and she's a registered dietitian with a PhD in nutrition science. She specializes in chronic disease prevention and teaches about the intersection of nutrition, food policy, and public health. So needless to say, your girl's got her credentials, okay, to talk on this subject. So what makes her stand out is how clearly and competently she explains what's real, what's hype, and what actually matters, especially as a mother herself. Her work is grounded in science, but also totally human and totally, I would say, reasonable. She's passionate about cutting through the noise and helping people understand food without shame, fear, or misinformation. I do think the internet is very much a fear-mongering system where we demonize ingredients and we tell our moms that their kids are going to have some harmful disease if they give their child like Lucky Charms. At least that's how I have felt recently. So in this episode, we get into everything from the viral claims you've seen on social media to the MAHA movement, because we got to talk about it, to how we filter out fear-based advice and actually feel confident in how you're feeding your family. This episode has been very informative for me, and I hope you all enjoy it just as much. Let's do it.
This is That Twin Mama Podcast. But hey, you don't have to be a twin mom to be here. I'm not like a regular mom. I'm a cool mom. So whether you are new, soon to be, or seasoned parent, or maybe you just hope to have kids someday, I promise you'll find something to love, learn from, or laugh at in each episode. I'm your host, Lauren Birdie. Let's do it.
All right. Welcome to the show, Dr. Nurek. I'm so excited for this conversation, Dave, because of so many moms that follow me or listen in, and including me, I'm just overwhelmed with all the information around nutrition and health that's currently going on around the internet. And so before we get into all the madness, welcome. But also, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself, why you're an authority on this topic, and also why you started to start talking about it on social media, which I am so grateful for, by the way. But anyways, welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much. Happy to be here. So I have a PhD in nutrition science, and I'm a registered dietitian, and my research was really focused on chronic disease prevention, which obviously is a very hot topic right now. Mostly cardiometabolic disease, so heart disease and type 2 diabetes, and looking at lifestyle interventions that could reduce risk of those diseases. So I've always worked kind of on the prevention side of things, and nutrition, physical activity, lifestyle factors. I got on social media actually back in 2022. Okay. I started making content, and it was predominantly focused on pregnancy and postpartum.
Yeah.
Because that's the life stage I was at. And so once you get in that life stage, you know, you start getting fed a lot of stuff with the algorithm about pregnancy and postpartum pregnancy. Yes. And I just started realizing how much misinformation was targeting people at that life stage. And so I was like, well, let me go on and just kind of like correct some of this stuff. And so that's where I started. But my content's very much evolved since then to be more aligned with kind of like what my research focus has been for the last 15 years, which is chronic disease prevention. And I really shifted it a lot because of kind of this Make America Healthy Again movement that came out last summer. And I just started, you know, because it's my exact area of research and focus, like it was just so easy for me to see kind of the manipulation that was happening and the misinformation that was coming out of the movement. And so I started kind of talking more about like chronic disease prevention and public health and the MAHA movement, really.
And I'm really appreciative that you did. And I think like, while you were focused on pregnancy and postpartum, like even the MAHA movement or anything around nutrition, I think just moms in general are a vulnerable community. Like we like are targeted all the time because we want our kids to feel safe. We're going to react to fear, I think, just because we have like a family. So my algorithm is all over the place, but a lot of it is like, this could cause your kid ADHD. This is this, like, there's so much things that I've actually removed stuff from my household, not knowing if it was true or not. And so I was just it was so refreshing to find your page, because I think what I found you on, you were stitching another viral video that was multiple people were doing it, where there was like an ingredient in a cereal, which really was like salt is what it broke down to. But they go to Home Depot and say, this is in the cereal and this is in this. Yeah. What in the word, what was the ingredient?
Because I think it was like potassium. I can't remember exactly. I think potassium phosphate or something.
Yeah. Something where
bicarbonate. I don't remember.
Yeah. Something like that, where it doesn't like, if you didn't study science, you might think it's...
Oh, it was trisodium phosphate.
Okay.
It just popped in my head.
But I don't know what that is, but that was like trending everywhere. I saw the original video and then I saw your stitch and I like kind of believed the original video. I didn't know at the time, you know? And so I think that what you're doing is just such a need. There's a gap, and it's not about like being super political. It's just using science and kind of saying, hey, there's a lot of stuff going on out here. This is what could be true, or this is what's based on like actual science, which is refreshing.
Yeah, thank you.
Of course. And so before we get into, I want to play a little game called Fact or Fiction. We'll just go through some of like the trending things that we're seeing on the internet about, is this true? Is this going to cause like whatever that we've all been seeing? But before we do, I do think there is like this narrative of just, you hear, especially from RFK Jr., MAHA, everyone's saying that we have our food industry is mass poisoning our people, right? And Trump is like saying the industrial food complex is harming America's. So just to ground us and like, you know, maybe there's some commonality here, but do you think, Dr. Nurek, that the food system is making us sick, or are those claims overstated? And we'll get into more nuanced detail, but I'm just basically wondering if that part, do you agree with or disagree with?
Yeah, I think that our food system is not set up to keep us healthy by any means. But I and we'll talk about this, but I differ from them in terms of like why our food system is contributing to illness. You know, we have a food system that right now is about 70% ultra processed foods, which that's a specific definition in nutrition research, which is essentially it contains an ingredient or some sort of processing method that you can't replicate in your own kitchen. And so they're prepackaged a lot of the time. They're high in sugar, high in fat, high in sodium, nutrient devoid, right? They don't have fiber. They don't have a lot of other like redeeming nutrients in them. And so because of that, that's what we're overwhelmingly consuming. And when you look at what the dietary patterns are in terms of what Americans are actually consuming, they're not healthful dietary patterns. And a large reason for that is our food environment, which was really built for corporations and not for our health.
Right. It's like what's making money, what's cheap to create, I feel like is like what I think ultra processed foods in general have been a big trigger word that's kind of circulating. But let's get into like factor fiction, because I think when people see processed foods, they're like, oh, this is automatically bad. But there's a range, right, of what can be processed and what is safe or what have you. Can you kind of go into a little bit about that, about like,
yeah. Well, let me just define ultra processed even more so. So, and I'll give you an example. So like in nutrition research, there's four categories. There's unprocessed, minimally processed, processed, and ultra processed. And so the best example is corn, right? Yeah. So the corn, if you could just go to like the garden and you pick out an ear of corn, that would be unprocessed, right? You're just picking something out of the garden. You know, minimally processed would be maybe some like corn, like canned corn, where there's a little, minimally processed. Yeah, minimally processed would be frozen corn, where it's just like kind of like frozen kernels. Processed would be canned corn, where there's like some salt added. And then ultra processed would be Dorito chips. Right. Where the corn has been integrated. And it doesn't just have to be Dorito chips, by the way. Like, I always like go to those, like what we would deem like unhealthy foods. But, you know, there's a lot of within each one of those. So like processed, for example, most of our food is processed. If you and I cook in our kitchen, we're processing that food. Yeah. So processed is just a means of like making food more like taste better. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Right. So even within ultra processed, there's like variations in ultra processed. And I don't know that a lot of wellness influencers realize this, but a lot of the protein powders that they promote are ultra processed. Yeah, I mean, you're not making that in your kitchen, you know?
That's totally true. That's I didn't even think about that because that's completely true. I'll see like a wellness influencer saying something is bad, but then also promoting like this health shake that they are probably getting paid for, which is...
Yeah, which is probably ultra processed.
Exactly. It didn't come like that in this powder form with collagen and whatever else, you know what I mean?
When I'm talking about like ultra processed foods and how we're over consuming these ultra processed foods, I do try to delineate and say, you know, when we're talking about that, we're really talking about these high sugar, high sodium, high fat, like nutrient devoid ultra processed foods. Because again, there's variability in ultra processed foods, and ultra processed foods are really important, by the way, for food accessibility, which is a whole different issue. There's just so much nuance within it. But overall, at an individual level, we would be better off if we were consuming more minimally processed food, you know, and less ultra processed food.
That's super helpful. I'm so glad you defined that. Okay, so let's get into some of the things that have also been just circulating. I think that one thing that people are dying on the hill for is like seed oils being like the worst thing in the world, like RFK. Maha have definitely said that. And I think even outside of that, but seed oil somehow made it into my home as well. Like my husband, one day we normally cook with like olive oil, all different kinds of oils. But when I do like Asian types food, I use my sesame oil. He's like, no, we can't do seed oils. I was like, why? He's like, because they said it's bad. I was like, who's they? He's like, I don't know. It's just bad. And so it just kind of like turned into this thing. So I'm sure this happens for a lot of different families, but let's just talk seed oils first. Is it bad? As people say, what's your thoughts on it? What does the science say?
Yeah. So I'm sure we'll talk about other things like food dyes where there's a bit more nuance there. Seed oils honestly is the most perplexing thing I've ever experienced because, and I talked to so many of my colleagues about this and we're all just like so confused because first of all, I had never heard of the term seed oil. You know, I have a PhD in nutrition science. I had never heard of this term until a few years ago on social media. Like this is just a social media made up term. Like we call them vegetable oils. We call them, you know, polyunsaturated fatty acids, or we call them by the oil that we're actually studying or looking into. But seed oils is very much like an online social media kind of like term. It genuinely flies in the face of nutrition science research. Listen, if seed oils were the cause of all our problems, I would be the first person to like step up and say, like, I'm not like in big seed oils pocket. I don't care about seed oils. I don't even really use them personally. Like, I'll use them occasionally, but it's not like my preferred oil. I would prefer like olive oil or something, but it just literally flies in the face of nutrition science research. So we have so much data, longitudinal epidemiological data and actual like looking at if you like switch out polyunsaturated fatty acids, which is the type of fat you're getting from seed oils, with saturated fat, how that can if you remove saturated fat and add in polyunsaturated fatty acids, that can reduce risk of heart disease. And there is a study that just came out, a longitudinal study that can reduce risk of heart disease related deaths. Right.
Really?
And there's a lot of research to show this. Yeah. There's just not research to show that like putting in beef tallow in place of seed oil is in any way like health promoting. This is a perplexing one. It's just not evidence-based. If it were, like we would acknowledge that. Seed oils are also, by the way, used all around the world. Widely all around the world. In a lot of these countries that we kind of hold up on a pedestal as like these health halos, like for example, Japan. A lot of people in like the Maha movement always point to Japan as like this like really healthy place with this low obesity rate and low chronic disease rate. The number one oil used in Japan is rapeseed oil, which is what we call canola oil here. They're using a lot of these seed oils all around the world. My mother-in-law lives with us half the time and she's from Romania and that's all she buys is vegetable oil. Like that's her oil of choice. But, I do think that there is some nuance here though. So what the problem is with seed oils is that, you know, they don't, they go through a lot of processing because it's pretty hard to extract the oil from the seed. They don't have a lot of like redeeming nutrients outside of their fatty acid profile. So for example, like olive oil or coconut oil or avocado oil, those types of oils, they have like some nutrition in them, right? Some like nutrients. So you can point to, oh, these are like nutrient devoid oils essentially because they go through that processing. And because of that, they're cheap to produce and they are don't have a strong flavor profile, like let's say olive oil. And so because of those things, they're used in pretty much all of our ultra processed foods, right? Because these corporations are trying to make their foods as cheap as possible. And so they're using these seed oils. And so because we're over consuming ultra processed food, we tend to over consume these polyunsaturated fatty acids, and the overconsumption of anything is problematic to health.
Right. That makes sense. Like if you have too much of anything, I mean, I don't think water is a good example, but you can drink
water
too much
is a good example
and get sick. Like we need it to live. But like, I literally had a friend go on a hike and I don't know what happens, but he passed out. He drank too much water in too much a period of time. And was like, that was something that happened. So too much of anything, I think that's a good thing to name, is going to have a negative effect health-wise. And seed oils, like you're saying, are just in everything. Sounds like they're in all the ultra processed foods. So it's not literally the seed oil, which we're calling this made up term, but it's not the vegetable oil, the canola oil. It's more like just be everything in moderation, everything like with different types of like limitations. That's super helpful. And I can't wait to bring sesame oil now back into my
house. I was going to say, that's a good example. Like this, if you're not using like, you know, if you're not eating a ton of ultra processed foods and just dousing all your food in seed oils, if you want to take out sesame oil for an Asian recipe, like there's absolutely no problem with that.
Okay. Yeah. I'm my husband. Yeah. I'm like going to ping this. This is going to be a click now. I'm going to be like, hey, we can bring sesame oil back. Yeah. And the beef tallow thing you're saying too, I follow a couple influencers that are, I don't really follow them anymore, but they've been like just putting beef tallow in everything. And I'm like, where did that even come from? Why are we doing this? Is that something that's very like nutritional value? Is it, why are people replacing it instead of seed oils? Isn't there probably some sort of risk with having beef tallow all of a sudden in everything? Like, I'm just curious what your thoughts on that are exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, beef tallow is like the fat of you know, beef, right? Like it's like the fat of the organ fat, like coming out, like, so anyway,
the hard part is probably not going to be this anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that it comes down to kind of this idea that a lot of us have that like natural is better. Mm-hmm. And so there, you know, because seed oils go through this like processing and extraction phase, it's like, oh, that's unnatural, even though it's like the oil from a seed, right? It's unnatural. And, you know, beef tallow, this fat from an animal is natural. And so that's better. And I think that that's kind of pervasive right now on like in social media narratives and things like that. But that's not always the case, first of all. But I understand the appeal. I used to also like kind of, even still, I'm like, oh, that it must be better because it's natural. It's not always the case. But I just think that people don't really. So you have to think of it on an individual level and a public health level. On an individual level, you know, some people, it may be fine if you like utilize some beef tallow with some other sources, right? I wouldn't just like over consume beef tallow. That's going to be a big issue. But on a public health level, for example, if we're swapping out seed oils and using beef tallow in place of them, that's going to be disastrous from a cardiometabolic health perspective. All of the research that we have to date shows us that. And in a place where we're already dealing with a lot of cardiovascular disease, that's not really the right move.
Right. I'm you're making a good point just about the whole like natural versus, you know, like being better, because I'm seeing a lot with like raw milk consumption too. I don't know where the heck that has come from, but like people are like, your milk needs to be warm and chewy. Like a lot of pregnant women, I think, literally, I'm like, that's disgusting. Well, in my mind, I feel like it's disgusting, but... is there a problem with, like, I don't even know if people understand what pasteurized means, like the process of what that's doing to milk, because what is the thing with raw milk? Is it, I'm just curious your thoughts, because that's another thing that's.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that everyone knows what pasteurization is. I was talking about this in my stories a couple months ago, and I got a DM that was like, oh my gosh, thank you for explaining pasteurization, because I always thought it was adding chemicals to the milk based on like how it's talked about.
Yeah. And, okay, let's define pasteurization for listeners who may not know.
Yeah, it's just heating milk. So you take the milk. I mean, the most common, there's a couple of ways to do it, but the most common is you heat it up. I think it's like, I can't remember exactly, 161 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds. So not even to boiling. You heat it up 15 seconds and then you rapidly cool it. And that's it. And it kills pathogens, right? It kills like the stuff from the cow's belly, which contains a lot of these pathogens. And you know, it's also coming out of the udder, which is, cows aren't clean. If you've ever been to a dairy farm or seen cows, like they're not clean. It kills all of that stuff.
Okay. Yeah. So raw milk consumers, I would just do whatever you want, but that's what pasteurization means. And so that might be another thing we can potentially debunk. Okay. Let's get into.
Well, and a lot of people, it's interesting because they'll say, you know, I grew up drinking raw milk, right? Or I grew up on a dairy farm. And then, but many of them always boiled the milk, right? And sometimes we don't like consider that pasteurization, but that's what they were doing. They were boiling it. Your grandma was boiling it in order to kill those pathogens, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if there's like a correlation too with just like the trad wife like phenomenon right now and then all these things coming up. I'm not sure. I just like thought of it right now, but you see a lot of moms like being on a dairy farm and doing things to it. And I think people are just like, yeah, I want to just consume this from the udder because this is good. This is natural and chemical free and not always understanding like why something is heated up to kill pathogens and bacteria that could be potentially harmful if you consume.
Yeah. You can get a lot of conditions, a lot of diseases from raw milk.
Yeah.
Like tuberculosis.
Kind of a big deal. Okay, let's get into food dyes because I feel like that's another one that people have been talking about. I know that like, I think it was what Red 3 causes cancer, so that was banned. So I guess what I'm wondering is your thoughts on food dyes. Are they all bad? Does banning necessarily mean that it's very harmful? Like those kind of narratives are associated with food dyes, if you could break it down.
Okay, so I have quite a nuanced take with food dyes, but let me just explain. Let's talk about the red dye 3, for example. So because this is an example of how our regulatory system, like our regulatory system in action. So red dye 3 was shown in the 80s in a couple of studies to cause, which is a key word, cause tumor growth in rats. That was through very high doses through a mechanism that most scientists don't think that is applicable to humans. So through a mechanism we don't have at a really high dose, like a pretty high percentage of their body weight, like something that we would never be exposed to. So really high dose through a mechanism not involved with humans. The thing is, though, is we have something in the U.S. called the Delaney Clause. And if any food additive or if any additive has been shown to cause cancer, it has to be removed from the food supply. No matter how, like the dose, no matter the model, like animal, human, anything. So what happened was a scientific group, they basically petitioned the FDA a few years ago to have red dye 3 removed because of those studies and because of the Delaney Clause, not because there's ever been any harm shown in humans. There hasn't, but because of it was shown to cause cancer in those rats. And so that was what happened. They petitioned the FDA. The FDA reviewed it, and because of that legal clause, they removed it from the. Well, they're currently removing it from the food supply. Yeah. I will say too, red dye 3. I think people confuse it with red dye 40. Red dye 3 is not used nearly as much as red dye 40. Red dye 3 is used like in maraschino cherries a lot, and like in a couple of other things. But like I was seeing social media posts when this was happening with like all of these like really common foods that like kids eat all the time. Right. And I was just like, no, that's red dye 40. Like that's not being banned.
That's so true. Because I love my husband, but like we would look at like Gatorade and like, this has the red, whatever, it's red 40, not red 3.
Yeah,
I
think that's red 40.
Conflating the two.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is your take on like food dyes in general? Like, should they all be kind of, like are they good? They're not good for us, right? Or are they harmful for us?
Well, no, they're not. They're not good for us. No, they're not like health foods. So
not the rainbow that we should be consuming.
So we have artificial food dyes, right? These are the synthetic dyes: red dye 40, blue 1, yellow 5, all of those. And then we have natural dyes. So like for red, there's red dye 40, which is like bright color. But the benefits of it from a food science perspective, it's, you know, it's a bright color. It also is pretty stable, right? And so it's like, it helps with the texture too, because it's so like, it's stable and it like keeps the texture of the food. Whereas some of these natural dyes, like for example, the alternative to red dye 40 would be like carmine, which we get from bugs, which I don't know that a lot of people know, or red, like beet, beet juice is another one. But using those, they're less stable. They can change the texture of the food a bit. And they're definitely not as bright, right? So there have been cases where, for example, in 2015, General Mills, because of like the public, what they thought that the public wanted, saying that they wanted more of these natural dyes, they changed. So they, I think in like all of their cereals, like Lucky Charms and Trix, they changed out these food dyes and used natural dyes. And they got so much backlash for it. And their sales dropped so much that 2 years later, they had to put back in the synthetic dyes because it turned out that the people who were asking for the natural dyes weren't actually the people eating the cereal who appreciated the other dyes. So yeah. So the thing with food dyes is you asked me about health. So I'm kind of talking more about like why we use them. Right. So there's pros and cons to these food dyes. What the literature says and what the research says, and there's a good amount of research on this, is that they are overwhelmingly not harmful at the doses that we're exposed to. But there is some correlational evidence to suggest that in a small percentage of like a small subset of kids with ADHD, it can exacerbate symptoms of ADHD. It doesn't cause, there's no evidence to suggest it causes ADHD, of course, even though I hear that often, but it can, but there's some research to show it exacerbates symptoms of ADHD in those kids. Now, the problem with that research is it's difficult to tease out. Is it the food dye itself? Is it the foods that contain these food dyes, which tend to be these high sugar, low nutrient foods? Is it like the environment the kids are eating these in, like at parties, like birthday parties with friends, those types of things? So that can be a little bit different to figure out. But I've heard, you know, lots and lots of parents swear that like when they remove these dyes, their kids, you know, are, you know, they see a change in their kids. You know, the difficult thing again is, again, are they removing the foods that they can, you know, are they, the only way to really see that is, you know, you take Skittles, which has these artificial dyes, and then we have like Giggles. Those are like another, I don't know if you've ever seen them. They sell them like Target and stuff, but they're like naturally, I think they're naturally colored like Skittles.
Okay, got it.
And cool. So like, if you're like exactly like exchanging that and then observing a difference, you would have to do that, right? If you just take out all the sugar and candy and ultra processed food, like, yeah, you're probably going to see a difference. So it's difficult, but here's the thing. Food dyes really are a marketing tool for companies, 100%. You know? And so as a dietitian, as somebody who like really cares about nutrition quality for our kids, I don't love them because I think that they're used in these high sugar, ultra processed foods generally. Right. And so I am not against like removing them and using natural dyes and in the hope that actually that might result in kids eating fewer or kids eating less sugar because they're not going to be as attracted to these foods.
Exactly.
But I want an honest conversation about that. Right. I don't want us to be saying these are toxic and poisoning our kids. And so we need to remove them from the food supply because there's just no evidence of that. Right. Yeah. There is some evidence to suggest that like we're more drawn to these really high, like bright colored foods that are really just marketed towards kids.
Yeah.
So, I
love that distinction too. Like two things you said, I want to call out is like, let's say you fed your kids Lucky Charms or Fruity Pebbles every day. And now you switch to egg whites and like acai bowls. And they're like, yeah, removing these food dyes, like totally did it. It's like, there's so many factors. Right. And then you're naming something around correlation and causation, right? Like when there can be like, and I want you to say more with that, because I think I saw an example you said around sharks attacking and things like that. And I wanted to give our listeners like context, because there can be things that correlate at the same time, but doesn't mean necessarily cause it. Can you give that shark reference? Because it was very helpful for me to understand.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is like the basic of like research methods or the basics of statistics is the difference between correlation and causation. And the problem is that these are conflated on social media all the time to manipulate people. Yeah. And so a correlation just means that two things are increasing or decreasing. They have a relationship. They're going in the same direction at the same time. The best example is shark attacks and ice cream sales, right? Yeah. So as shark attacks increase, ice cream sales increase. And it's a very strong correlation. Like I did a video on this. I showed the graph, like very strong. They increase at the exact same time. So what I said on that is it would be absurd to create a policy where you prohibit ice cream sales in order to prevent shark attacks. Right. So you see that these two things happen at the same time. And so you're like, okay, well, obviously ice cream sales are, are causing shark attacks. So let's allow ice cream sales to prevent shark attacks. But obviously that's not the cause, right? Yeah. They're just correlated because they both happen in the summer. So as the weather gets warmer, shark attacks increase and ice cream sales increase. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then after that, when I showed another graph, which are very strong correlation between autism rates and organic food sales. Right. And that's just over time. So, and that's the best way, by the way, to spread like propaganda is to just graph two things over time that like increase at the same time. Yeah. 'Cause lots of things increase at the same time over the last 20, 30 years. Right. So you graph, you know, autism rates, which have increased with organic food sales and have those increase. And I mentioned, you know, if I really wanted to spread propaganda about that, I would make up a mechanism and say, you know, these two things, look at how these increased at the same time. It must be the organic pesticides that they use in organic farming that's somehow causing inflammation in the brain and causing autism. Right. Yeah. And it's just really, really important to understand the difference between causation and correlation. We need specific types of studies to show that one thing causes another thing. A lot of things have correlational relationships and increase at the same time. That does not mean that one thing causes the other.
And I think that's genius because that is the propaganda, I think, on influencers with MAHA. It's like, this dye causes ADHD. Yeah. CDOs is causing it's just this blanket statement. And I think for moms listening or when you're consuming information, understanding that like science does acknowledge when there's correlations and then there's very like tight case studies to see if there's causation for that. Like, it's not like we're not acknowledging that there could be correlations of things.
No. And correlations are important to acknowledge. Like that's what you look for. You look for these relationships to then figure out, okay, well now we're going to design some studies to see if this is actually causing the other thing.
Exactly. And I think that understanding just that language and that rhetoric, y'all, is very important when we're like consuming different things from also like whatever sources, what is the source? Who is saying it? Is it someone that's basing it on science or is it someone just saying this worked for them and like spreading propaganda? We know what clickbait is. And I just feel like I've become victim of that. Like, and I feel like I'm not very gullible, but when it comes to health and things like that in my family, I feel like I'm second guessing everything I think about as a mom.
Especially, I mean, you mentioned this at the beginning, like especially moms, you know, like I feel like after I have a 5 and a 2-year-old and I feel like after I kind of like went through that period of time, like even me with my science background and my, you know, my logical brain, like I would see like stuff on social media and be like, oh my gosh, maybe that is hurting my kid, you know? It would just trigger something like so innate within me. And then I would like come to, you know.
Yes. Like, wait, hold on a second. Yeah. But I think they target us, especially in that time period too, when you're like a new mom, like you're not really getting sleep or, you know, you're really trying to have a healthy pregnancy, all the things. It's just, it's our nurturing, like there's something in our brain. We want to make sure we're doing the best for our kids.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think, I mean, whatever you want to call MAHA, it's a brilliant marketing scheme. And it's the influencers that are doing these wellness campaigns are actually brilliant at knowing what to do to trigger you, that fear aspect to get you to believe, to get you to buy, to get you to react. Mm-hmm. And I think just being aware of that, being aware of what you're consuming, be aware of like what the real estate on your brain is as you're consuming it as a mom, know you're vulnerable to that. But we'll get to that later to like understand how maybe we could talk about it now, like as a mom or as someone that is consuming so much media now, like the government is one thing, like it's just I don't know where to go to trust. Like, you were very refreshing to me because I don't feel like you're biased, you're more like just pointing out this isn't true, this is why, you know what I mean? And that's hard to find now. Like, even the news is like everything's biased, everything seems like a skit, but it's not, we're not looking up from it. So anyways,
I know.
Like, do you have advice for people who are seeking information or trying to know what's false, what's true, what's not?
Yeah. There's some things to look out for. Just, you know, things that like most people who are coming from a genuine place to just provide information aren't doing. So that's things like using really inflammatory inflammatory language, right? Like, I stitched a video, I think we were talking about it before we joined, you know, and it started with like, are you poisoning your kids?
Yes.
And like that kind of thing. And I stitched it right. And showed how that's, you're not poisoning your kids. I would just never do that.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
I would never, if something actually did come out that was really concerning, like I would try to come on, I would explain it and I would put it into context. And, you know, I wouldn't be like, are you poisoning your kids?
Yeah.
And so usually that kind of language, like when they're like trying to freak you out, mm-hmm. like that's a red flag. Right. Yeah. And so especially, by the way, especially if their caption is like, comment toxin for my free ebook.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So they like yes. scare the shit out of you in yes. the video. And then they like are trying to give you this free ebook. And then within the ebook are all these affiliate links to their like, you know, detox programs. Yes. Generally not a reliable person.
Yeah, red flag. Yeah. Yeah.
100%. Yeah.
I think also and thinking about that, and another one that was like had been trending with just like, you're poisoning your baby is like, there's high fructose corn syrup in formula. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I remember seeing this at the time. I wasn't breastfeeding or doing anything at that time. I did breastfeed both of my kids, but there are things I think particularly targeted at moms, pregnant moms, yeah. breastfeeding moms, things like that. And just to go back to like the fiction, like false or fiction, can we talk a little bit about high fructose corn syrup and if it is in formula? I know you did a video on this, but mm-hmm. that was one that was trending where there was a lot of stitching of like, you're going to kill your baby. And I'm like, wait, what? And like, it's just wild, wild clickbait. But give me yeah. your thoughts on that.
Infant formula is severely misunderstood.
Yes.
Because again, we talked about ultra processed, right? Mm-hmm. Infant formula is an ultra processed food. It right. has to be like, yeah. That's how it's created. And so basically, you know, again, this natural kind of tendency. And people just don't understand, like, why is there an ingredient list that's super long on this infant formula?
Right.
But if I showed you an ingredient list of breast milk, it would be just as long. It would be longer actually, because there's more things in breast milk.
Yeah.
And so the goal of infant formula is to mimic breast milk as close as possible. And so what that includes is it includes every single, and this is also a misconception, every single major formula manufacturer in the U.S. has a purely lactose-based formula, because lactose is the carbohydrate of breast milk, right? It's a milk sugar. Okay. There's plenty of options, like over a dozen options in the US of like these infant formulas that are solely lactose, absolutely no other sugar in there except lactose.
Yeah.
And so basically what those formulas would have is they'll have lactose, they'll have, you know, they'll have milk, and then they'll have maybe lactose added. But then also they need the fatty acid profile of breast milk is very different than cow's milk. So you yeah. can't just give cow's milk as the fatty acid profile. You need to add in other fats, because breast milk is much higher in polyunsaturated fatty acids than cow's milk. So okay. in infant formula, your base is cow's milk. For the most part, sometimes goat's milk, but yeah, your base is cow's right. milk. And then you add in, and we use vegetable oils to add in these polyunsaturated fatty acids. And so there's this idea that, like, you know, because of the rhetoric on seed oils, that like yeah. we're making yeah. these infant formulas toxic with these seed oils. And this is like a uniquely American thing, where every single infant formula around the entire world,
right.
without exception, I mean, I've never found an exception, contains seed oils. Right. All of them, all of the European ones that we hold in yeah. such esteem
right.
everywhere, they all contain seed oils, because we need those polyunsaturated fatty acids to mimic the fatty acid profile of breast milk. Now, on the sugar, if you yeah. want to move on.
I'm just frustrated, because I'm like, geez, there's just so much. Anyways. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
difficult to, I mean, yeah. we have to be on a podcast for me to like explain all right. of this. Right. Or I have right. to do like a 2 to 3 minute social media video,
right.
which just doesn't play as well as like
yes.
infant formula is toxic. They contain these toxic inflammatory seed oils and you're right. hurting your baby.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like
that always does better. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. yeah it's really a problem.
And I know you were saying, I think I like listened on one of you, a podcast that you're on, was just how I think, and tell me if I'm misquoting, but when you were getting your PhD, or scientists in general, when social media was just kind of starting, it wasn't looked as like, don't put your information on there. That's kind of like a weird media source of like, we don't need to do that. We're going to be reputable. But now it's like blown up. And I feel like real people who have the education and background to speak on this are playing catch up to like the, you know, mommy influencer with a million followers who has no fucking clue what she's talking about, but will be able to say something, and that reach will, you know, reach way more people than someone who doesn't have that.
Yeah, I'll give you a quick story about that. So back in 2016, I had just finished my PhD, and I was a professor at the University of Nevada. I was doing some things on social media. I was like following, I don't know if you know who Chalene Johnson is, but I was like following her back then at the time. And she's like a social media like coach. And I was like, let me go on social media, because I have all this nutrition and like knowledge. Yeah. Let me just like start talking. So I started going on and talking just about nutrition broadly. And I got so many comments from people, colleagues, you know, people from my PhD program, just kind of like making fun of me, being like, how's your vlogging going? Because it was very frowned upon as an academic to do that. And so I eventually stopped after a few months. I was like, okay, well, let me not do this. Let me like build my actual career. And so I do think that was for many, many years. Now it's so different. Now it's like we need more, like, come on, social media is where everyone's getting their information. But at the time, you know, we were like, oh, that's so like rookie league. Like, what are you doing on social media? And I do think that like held us back, right? Because while we were all like, oh, you can't go on social media in 2016, 2017, you know, social media influencers were gaining huge, massive followings and a lot of influence. And so now, you know, it is very difficult for a lot of us to break through. I've luckily had some success in the last few months, last year, I'd say. But, you know, we're playing catch up for sure.
Yes, for sure.
I was just going to say, and the other problem is that we don't sell products, right? A lot of us, we don't sell supplements. We don't sell products. So it's very difficult to monetize all of the time. I mean, it takes a lot of time to be on social media. And so to not be making money like these wellness influencers are, a lot of them are making millions. I mean, an article came out in the New York Times, Dr. Mark Hyman made $28 million in 2023 from all of his companies and his supplement sales. He had like 300,000 people buying supplements from him. And so, you know, we just don't do that, right? Like it's different. It's not monetizable as easily. And so you don't have a lot of scientists and medical professionals who have, you know, they have full-time jobs. And so they don't have a lot of time to just come and be like social media influencers. So I think that's a real problem as well.
I'm so appreciative you are, because as someone that does content, like, I know the time it takes. Like, it's not an easy thing to just do. Like, finding even the content that I'm sure people send you stuff all the time. Like, is this true? Is this true? And this true? And then like splicing it. But it's a time consuming effort, but like, you're doing like such good work. And I think it's just so needed. So I just like, I personally just really appreciate you taking up space.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's also a point of privilege, though, because I have a husband who makes enough money for us. So I was able to spend, you know, a year or two doing a lot of social media stuff, making $0. Not everyone can do that.
Not everyone can do that. Exactly. I'm thinking, too, just with social media, and just there is like some brilliance to the MAHA movement. Make America healthy again. Like, who doesn't want to make America healthy? Like, if you are against something that they say, it's like, oh, you don't want to make America healthy. I saw some quote somewhere, or maybe it was something through you, but like Democrats want poor people to have access to food, and Republicans are wanting our food to be healthier, or something like that. Around, it's just such a divisive thing around health where it shouldn't be. And I'm just curious from your perspective, because there is so much around the MAHA movement, and you've been talking a lot about it, but what do you think but it's also like influenced by pseudoscience and a lot of wellness influencers. So I want to ask two questions. One, why do you think it's so successful? And two, how do you think they're missing the mark? Because we did agree in the beginning, our food could be healthier, right? I think we all agreed on that. But what is missing the mark with MAHA? Why is it kind of not doing the job right?
Yeah, so I think you were referring to a comment that someone sent me, and then I did a video based on that comment about like how the only way that you could believe that is if you've just never paid attention to public health policy before, which to answer your question, I mean, I do think that that's a big part of this. I think that a lot of the MAHA movement has what they get right is that we have a lot of issues in this country health-wise. Public health experts have been trying to sound this alarm forever. You know, and I think what MAHA has done is they have, you know, basically been able to get people to believe that our issues are because of corrupt science and scientists and medical professionals, whereas it's just not the reality. The reality is that the science is very strong. We have great data on what is causing these chronic diseases. And we can, you know, and when I talk about chronic disease, I do want to make the distinction because these are the stats that are often cited. We're really talking about like the big four chronic disease, you know, like heart disease, diabetes, some cancers, respiratory disease, those types of chronic disease that can be impacted by lifestyle, can be impacted by food and exercise and things like that. And so, you know, we have these problems, but we have great data on what is causing these chronic diseases. And public health experts have been pushing forever for policy and for our politicians to support public health policy. And that's what hasn't been supported, because there's not a lot of money to be made in public health policy. In fact, it costs money up front, right? I mean, if you look down the road, it could save money, a lot of money. But initially it costs money. And so, you know, if we want to save taxes and things like that, it's usually pushed to the side. Those are usually the first programs to be cut. I mean, you can see right now in the Republican budget bill, in order to pay for their tax cuts, they're trying to cut $880 billion from the same budget where Medicaid cuts would come from. So we're trying to cut Medicaid. They're trying to cut $230 billion from the ag budget. 80% of the ag budget is SNAP, so the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So there's absolutely no way you can do that without cutting from nutrition assistance for low-income Americans. And so you know, these policies are being enacted that are going against public health. And so the narrative that it's because of the science that we don't have good science is just absolutely not accurate.
Bullshit. It's pissed me off, because it's like there's so much demonization of an ingredient. And it's like, look at this ingredient, like smoke and mirrors. Like, everyone look over here.
It's a distraction. It's a distraction. Food dyes, seed oils, that's all a distraction while they usher in policies that are actually hurting public health, not helping.
Right. But, like, literally, it's just, I don't even know if they're talking. I don't know if, like, maybe RFK had the best of intentions, but then the administration that you're attached to is doing so much harm in other ways where it's, I don't see how it's going to get better based on, like, I don't know.
And the thing is, I get asked often, like, well, what are the things you like about what he's doing? And like, I understand where that question's coming from. And I will be the first, I've admitted many times when like I agree with something he's doing. I just wrote a Substack article last week about the GRASS loophole, which is the generally recognized as safe loophole. And if he's trying to close that, like, I'm super supportive of that. I've been supportive of that for years. So it's not as if I'm like blinded by politics and I'm saying like anything he does is wrong. But the problem is that the small things like closing the GRASS loophole, it pales in comparison to all of the harm that's coming from kind of eroding trust in our science, eroding trust in our institutions. And then all of the policies that the current administration is enacting, you know, I could list them all. There's over a dozen that are just directly harming public health.
Right. And just because you mentioned it and people might not know, but like the GRASS loophole, can you give a little bit more context? Because it's more regulation, which is very like against what his administration. I don't know how that's going to work, but can you give a little bit more context to what?
Yeah. So GRASS is a designation called generally recognized as safe. It had really good intentions initially. So back in 1958, when the FDA, you know, they were going to regulate basically all of the food substances that were going to be added to foods, especially as like we started getting more food additives in the food supply. Right. And so what they decided was, okay, we're going to, you know, some of these food products like vinegar and salt and sugar, Like, they don't need to go through this whole process of being of like scientific evidence showing that they're safe, because we already know they're safe because they've been eaten for, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And so they had this designation generally recognized as safe. And again, that was for things like vinegar and salt and sugar and all of those that were just generally recognized as safe.
Right.
And so they still had to go through like generally recognized as safe approval, but it was different than like the lengthy process for like food additives. And so this was that's kind of how it went. If a company wanted to kind of like introduce a food ingredient and then they wanted to go through this generally recognized as safe designation, they needed to submit to the FDA all of this evidence. The FDA had to go through it and make sure that like there was sufficient evidence, and then it would get that designation through the FDA. That changed in 1997. You know, we were going through this like era through the 80s with Reagan, through the 90s with Bush, and then even Clinton, who was also like a very much deregulation. So we were seeing this like very big push for deregulation during that time. And with the FDA has notoriously been underfunded for forever because the FDA is funded through our tax dollars, right? So if we want to increase funding to the FDA, that increases our tax dollars.
Right.
So historically, it's been pretty underfunded. With food additives, all these food additives were coming to the market, and there was this huge backlog of food additives. And so it was taking forever for these corporations to get approval for these food additives through the generally recognized, well, for anything. And so what the FDA decided to do in 1997 was say, okay, so because we don't have the resources to be able to go through all of this quickly enough, what we're going to do is we're going to do a self-affirmation process where corporations can self-affirm that an ingredient is generally recognized as safe. Now, it's not as bad as what a lot of influencers are making it out to be. It's not great, but it's not as bad. They can't just say it's safe, right? They do have to, but basically they can appoint their own scientists and find their own panels to go through the evidence and figure out that it's safe. Now, the idea is that it's in the company's best interest to not put harmful things in their food, right? Because if they do that and it comes out like that, the company will be gone. Right. And so the idea is companies want to keep their food safe. So they'll pay for it. They'll go through the self-affirmation process. And by the way, this is very similar to what happened with pharmaceuticals. Well, actually not similar, but similar in terms of like the whole, we don't have enough resources at the FDA. You may have heard, that, you know, the FDA is funded by big pharma and they're the same people they're supposed to regulate are funding them. What gets lost in that is that that's not like the FDA paying or that's not like pharmaceutical companies paying the FDA, like lobbying them or anything. It's user fees, right? Which is, and this happened a few years before. This is why I'm bringing it up. So this happened, I think in 1992 under the Bush administration. So it was just an era of deregulation. And what happened with the pharmaceutical industry is the same exact thing. The FDA was backed up. They didn't have enough time to go through all of these, like, they didn't have the resources to go through kind of this process. And so they needed more resources. And so Congress wouldn't allocate any more funds to the FDA. And so what they decided to do was charge a pharmaceutical company's user fees in order to bring on more staff so that they could go through the entire FDA approval process for these pharmaceutical drugs. And so it's that's why about half the FDA is funded by the pharmaceutical industry. It's in the form of user fees, which is not uncommon. Like if you think about like the aeronautical industry, like the aviation industry, like they have to pay user fees in order to go through this process of kind of regulating them. So basically pharmaceutical companies pay the FDA to kind of go through a user fee, all the same like fees. It's not, and they don't get like special treatment because everybody's doing it. And that was because we didn't have enough funds at the FDA. So that was essentially what it is.
That's wild because, I mean, I didn't know that. I'm learning something new every day. And I feel like your average person, like your brain is fascinating too. Like the dates that you're recalling and like all these like statistics, because as a mom or as someone that didn't have a science background, how do we like your average listener, your average consumer isn't going to know these things. Right. Yeah. And I don't expect them to, like, if you're a scientist, but if you were told to read something you maybe didn't study in school, you might not know what you're looking at. Right.
Totally.
Like not someone that actually has a PhD. For advice for parents, if we're looking for We know what to like not look at. Like you said, not like demonizing an ingredient or like clickbait, like your baby's going to die if these could be like flags of some misinformation. Mm-hmm. Are there flags for good information, or are there mm-hmm. resources or things that you look to that are, you know, like legible, like for moms, like could we read it? Like not a scientific article, I'm not going to understand that, but something that maybe is trustworthy that could break down facts besides you.
Besides me.
Well, that's all I got right now.
I think it's helpful to look for information. I mean, if you're on social media, right, look for people who are like qualifying their statements, right? You'll hear me do that a lot. I'll say, you know, like, this is what it showed, but that's not the whole story. Like with like the FDA, this whole thing with the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA, it got really like sensationalized on social media because it's really easy to do that. It's easy to take these stories that people don't really know the truth about, like why they don't know the history, and manipulate it to like drive a narrative, right? It's so easy to be like, I can't believe that half the FDA is funded by the pharmaceutical industry, the very industry they're supposed to be regulating. Which sounds like corrupt. That sounds like pretty wild. Corrupt. Yeah. And so it's really easy to use stories like that to like basically erode the trust of the public without. Right. But then like the whole backstory is that, I mean, that's been supported by Republican Party, the Republican Party forever since it was enacted during the Bush one. Yeah. So I did a whole video on that, by the way, and like showed like how much Fox News was like super positive and like pro the user fees.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny because everyone forgets this. Like Michelle Obama had a whole initiative of like getting our kids.
They really do forget that. They forget that.
And like Fox News was like, no, don't take away our McDonald's. And like,
I digress. Yeah, we could talk about the Obama administration as well. But so I mean, look for people who qualify their sentences. Look for people who cite their sources. You know, I never try to. One of my goals when I'm like giving information, I try to really like not lean into like trust me because I have a PhD. Trust me. I try to like not the appeal to authority. I try to not like do. I try to, if you are going to trust me, you're going to trust me because I'm showing you evidence of these things. Right. And I'm giving a logical argument for why this is the case. So look for people.
I think it's important though, that you have credibility though there. Like, I do think there are a lot of people who I'm like, you're speaking as an expert on, it doesn't even have to be about nutrition, on marriage, but you've never been married or something like that. Or on like, I'm like, what's
or parenthood and you're not a parent.
Yeah. And like, you're a 20-year-old, like, you know, coming, like, how are you speaking on this? What's your authority? So I do think having some sort of, I love that you have a background in this because it does make me trust you more. However, obviously that doesn't matter to most people now. Because people are trusting folks without it. But yeah, I think what you're saying is the information is like actually more important than me.
Well, 100%. And I do think that like you should look for people who are experts in their field, right? And it's very interesting because I get asked all the time things wildly outside of my scope of practice. So I have a PhD in nutrition science. I'm an expert in, you know, preventing chronic disease, public health, like that kind of thing. But people will ask, you know, what about a vaccine safety?
Yeah.
I'm not a vaccine expert, so I will point people. I'll point people to those experts: immunologists, microbiologists, vaccinologists, people who's epidemiologists, people who've studied vaccines. Or people will ask me, like, "What do you think about this, like, you know, skincare product?" And that's not my expertise. But what it says to me is that people are really, really used to just going to one person for all of their information. And expertise is really specific and it's really important to understand, right? Like, even medical doctors, this happens with medical doctors. People think that medical doctors know everything about everything. Well, not so much. You know, a lot of people, they'll go to their medical doctor for everything. And just because they are an MD, they're like, oh, this person knows about everything, when that's just not the case. They're an 100%. Expert in their area of expertise.
100%. Same with attorneys. Yeah. Like, my dad's an attorney. My mom will be like, go to him for this. It's like, he's not going to know, mommy. He could find out, but like, that's not the type of practice that he does. So I think that's a really good point. I think also people are just kind of lazy straight up. Like, they want all the information in one place. They read a comment and they take it as fact. They don't ever go back to like fact checked or what have you. So they found you, they trust you. Like, can you tell me all the answers to everything else? And I think that says something to your integrity where you could capitalize on that and be like, yeah, this is what I use. This is what I would do. Where I think there's a lot of folks that do, not necessarily experts, but you see a lot of people becoming expert fields in something that went viral on their page. Like, now I'm a wellness influencer. Now I am like I'm an ADHD specialist because I'm diagnosing myself with it, what have you. And I think that does say something to just your integrity, where you're not going to speak on something that you aren't an expert on, or that you don't know all the full information on, which makes me honestly trust you a little bit more than I think other people. Okay. I want to, like, as we close, I want to take some time to get questions from like real moms who knew that you were coming on and just had all these questions. I think we've answered a lot. But I think a lot of it comes down to, I can't afford organic. I can't afford these whole foods anymore. What am I supposed to do? I rely on school lunches. Is that really bad? And they feel guilty for the fact that I don't know how to provide my children with quality meals. Am I a terrible parent? What do I do? What's the answer for me? And I'm curious what your thoughts are. I think that's a systemic thing there going on, but I'm curious your thoughts for the mom who just can't afford like going to Whole Foods or what have you, like every day, or growing a garden.
Yeah, a couple of things. So one, I just want to speak to the systemic thing. This is exactly why a lot of times people are, they focus so much on personal choice. And there's definitely an aspect to health of personal choice, right? Mm-hmm. But we make personal choices within systems. And mm-hmm. so when a system is set up the way that it is for so many Americans, millions and millions of Americans to fail, we can't then turn around and blame that person for failing in a system that's set up for them to fail. And so that's why I talk so much about like systems. And I talk about, you know, in our food environment, let's just take a food, for example. Yes, the ideal would be eat as many whole foods as possible. Yeah. Eat protein at each meal. Eat fiber, meet your fiber needs, because over 90% of Americans aren't meeting fiber needs, right? Eat fruits and vegetables and all of that. Great. But at the same time, we're looking at a food system that's 70% ultra processed foods, where we have millions of people living in food deserts, 13.5% of Americans living in food insecure households, where they don't always have access to the nutrients that they need to meet their nutrient needs, right? And so when you think about that, and then you're just telling someone like eat more fruits and vegetables, that's there's a disconnect there, right? And so it's very difficult to talk about individual choice without talking about the systems that surround those individual choices.
Yes. So, go on, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was like, and they're heavily affecting our low-income communities. Like that's like that's what it is. There's no Whole Foods on the corner of a low-income community normally. Like there's no access, or that's just something that I'm
well, and that's one of my biggest problems with the MAHA movement is it's very much a middle to upper class, you know, movement fueled for other middle to upper class people, right? So they don't have to worry about food insecurity. They don't have to worry about food deserts. They don't have to worry about all of these things because they have all of those met. They have the luxury of worrying about like red dye 40 in a high sugar ultra processed food. Right. Do you know what I mean? So a lot of these things that are actually the things that could improve public health the most, because if you look at who is affected by chronic disease in this country the most, it's overwhelmingly low income populations. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence to show that, you know, if you look at a map and you look at poverty and then you look at chronic disease, it's very similar, those two maps of America. And there's evidence to show that there's a 15-year life expectancy age gap for men and a 10-year life expectancy age gap for women between the highest and lowest income brackets. So if you want to improve chronic disease and you want to improve health, you know, we talk about, RFK Jr. talks about life expectancy all the time. If you want to improve that in America, you target the populations that are most negatively impacted by these things. And that's low income populations, right? And so instead, this current administration is taking away support programs for those same populations, right? Yeah. And that's why I talk about so much how like food dyes and seed oils are a distraction. So we are all focused on these MAHA bills, like in West Virginia, they're going to remove, you know, food dye from their food supply. While West Virginia, by the way, ranks lowest in all of these health outcomes.
Right.
You know, they have the worst diabetes rates in the country. They have the worst healthcare system in the country. And yet they're not going to, you know, put any effort into that, but they're going to remove red dye 40 for like, I don't know, MAHA.
Right. It's like, it's smoke and mirrors. And it's just, I think like the marginalized community, they don't care. Straight up, they don't fucking care.
Yeah.
If you're not in your little bubble, like, honestly, I'm curious to see what happens in the next few years. But unfortunately, I think that a lot of the base that might be low income that voted for MAHA or voted on this idea is going to be left behind. So all to say, as you are go on.
Let me just answer your question though, yeah. for that person. You don't have to eat at Whole Foods. You don't have to.
Got it.
Don't. Yeah. You know, like the vast majority of Americans, I mean, if you look at like our health and like where we are in terms of like the what we're doing, over 90% of Americans don't meet vegetable and fiber guidelines. Over 70% are eating too many calories for their needs. 50% are eating too much added sugar. And 80% aren't meeting physical activity guidelines. So we have in our you know, country, we're overwhelmingly not meeting these guidelines. And you can work to meet those guidelines without going to Whole Foods, right? You can eat, you know, fiber. Beans are a really good source of fiber, right? So you can choose some of these like lower, you know, beans and rice are actually a great option. You're going to get a lot of nutrition in those. And then, you know, just buying normal produce. I think people think that they have to buy this like super expensive organic produce. And what happens is then they don't eat any vegetables at all. Cause they're like, well, these strawberries are $9. I'm not paying that. And so then they just don't buy strawberries. Whereas it would be much more beneficial to just buy the cheaper strawberries, and integrate those into your meals.
Yeah. Versus no fiber at all. That makes sense. Okay. Jessica, this has been amazing. Like incredible. Before we wrap up, what's one thing that you would want moms to remember? We've talked about a lot, but what's one thing that you would want moms, like a lot of my listeners are new moms or pregnant or have littles, what would you want them to remember or take away from this episode or in general, if we did not speak about something?
I think that we are in an information age where we have so much information at our fingertips, but information can be available and not accessible a lot of the time. So if we don't have kind of like the background to understand it, it can seem very scary. And so I would just say, and there's a lot of people out there trying to capitalize on that fear and trying to capitalize on the fact that we're in a really vulnerable time of our lives. And so to just be aware of that, like even like hearing that and being more aware makes you a better consumer of information, right? Because you're so, I've had so many people like reach out to me and be like, oh my gosh, once you kind of like showed this to me, it's like impossible to unsee. Like I see the playbook, right? The fear and then the sale. The fear and the sale. And it just happens all the time on social media. So just being conscious of that. And you know, things aren't as scary as they seem. Like just do your best. Try, you know, it's difficult to like, I have a 5-year-old right now who doesn't want to really eat the rainbow as I would like him to.
Right.
Just, I'm just doing the best that I can. And he's a thriving 5-year-old boy and he's doing just fine. Despite what social media might have me believe, you know, so you know best and don't let all the fear mongering kind of like take over your anxiety.
I love that. Cause we're all just trying to do our best. My girls are in like a beige era where they literally will only eat things that are like pasta, like look beige and then like red would be ketchup. And I'm like, I'll make a smoothie every day to just hopefully get that in them. But who knows if they're going to consume it, but I'm not going to beat myself up for it. I think what you're saying too, like my wool has been pulled over my eyes, like now looking at your content and I can just see the playbook when I'm like being influenced and just having that awareness. I can take what I want from it or not, but it's just that awareness. I will link a lot of the videos that have done that really impacted me from Dr. Nurik in the show notes, because I think that could be a great place to start. Where can folks follow you along and your journey and all the information that you're sharing?
Instagram is probably the best place. And then I also have a Substack, which is I publish twice a week. And so Instagram is Dr. Jessica Nurik. And then Substack, I don't really know. I think it's just my name.
I think it's subscribed and it's amazing. You should write a book or something or do a podcast. We just need more of you.
When
you have the time, because you're not doing enough now, obviously. But thank you, Dr. Nurik. It's been amazing to connect with you. I know this episode is going to help so many moms. Thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next week.
And that's a wrap for this episode of That Twin Mama Podcast. But before you go, let me tell you how you can keep this village growing. First things first, are you subscribed? If not, what are you doing? Hit that subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening so you never miss a new episode. We're streaming on all major platforms, so let's make it official. Secondly, let's stay connected on socials. Follow us on That Twin Mama Podcast on Instagram for short form relatable content, and follow us on YouTube at That Twin Mama Podcast for entire episodes in all of their glory. And lastly, and this is a big one, if you liked what you heard today, please leave a review. Your 5-star love means so much to me and the team behind the scenes and helps us to keep going. It also helps us to find parents like you who need to listen to these episodes, which mean the world. So until next time, take care of you, take care of your crew, and remember, you're doing an amazing job. See you soon. Peace.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.